Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source of insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. This show is for early August 2022. Today we have a special show. As part of our ongoing collaboration with Steve Sherlock at the Franklin Matters podcast, we get to talk to Representative Jeff Roy, who's one of the major architects of the climate bill that is currently on Governor Baker's desk. Representative Jeff Roy comes from the 10th Norfolk District in Massachusetts, which I'm happy to say includes my hometown of Franklin. But he's also the chairman of what's called the Telecommunications Utility and Energy Committee, the TUE Committee, through which all climate legislation must pass. And in that role, Jeff was an important architect of the Very Good Climate Bill, as I say, that is now on the governor's desk. So when we talk to Jeff, it's all very, of course, literally wrote the bill. So he knows what's in it, why it's important, what the motivations are. Fascinating conversation. His advice? Question mark. What does he think you ought to do? He thinks you ought to call Governor Baker and tell Governor Baker to sign the legislation. The phone number is 617-725-4005. Anyway, we're thrilled to have Representative Jeff Roy on the podcast in collaboration with Franklin Matters. That's what you're going to hear. And I hope you enjoy it as much as we enjoyed recording it.
So if you didn't hear me earlier in the program, you need to call the governor and urge him to put his signature on this bill.
617-725-4005. Perfect. Write that on the back of your hand. Get a pen right now. Write it on the back of your hand and call the governor.
Steve Sherlock for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR.FM and in the local Franklin Mass FM dial at 102.9. Here today for another session of Making Sense of Climate, I've got my guide, Ted McIntyre. And Ted, we have a special guest with us today.
I am thrilled to be part of this conversation.
Absolutely. And State Rep Jeff Roy, it's good to see you in this virtual mode, and we appreciate taking time from your schedule. I know you've got some busy things happening because the major piece that we want to talk about is still in the air, literally.
In the air. It's down to one person, the governor of the Commonwealth. I said in my remarks the other day, of the 6.4 million people in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, one was selected to decide things of this nature. And that happens to be the governor. So the bill has been through both chambers, the House and the Senate, twice. It now sits on his desk, and he has the choice, only three choices. He can sign it, and it becomes law. He can veto it, and it comes back to the legislature. Or he can take no action, and it becomes law without his signature. So he has until August 11th to make that determination. And I have said to folks that, you know, I was a trial lawyer before I got into the legislature, and waiting for verdicts from juries was probably the most knot-tying experience I had as a trial lawyer. And that's exactly how I feel waiting for the verdict from the governor as to whether he's going to sign the bill.
Indeed. And for the listeners to just help frame the conversation while we're attempting to today, certainly if you've been listening to our continuing series of Making Sense of Climate and, yeah, helping Steve make sense of climate, and Ted's been our chief guide. We've had some other guests along the way, and State Rep Roy is our Franklin representative, but also holding the unique position as chair of the TUA, the Technology, Utilities, and Energy. Did I get that right?
Telecommunications.
Telecommunications.
Yeah.
committee, which then gave you the role to, as you said, marshal the climate bill through both chambers, through the conference committee as well. Now it's sitting on the governor's desk. So what we want to do today is kind of frame, okay, what's in the bill? What do we need to know about it? And then clearly the decision, we may have to come back depending after August 11th and find out what happens and see what the next steps are. But Ted, why don't we start framing it in terms of this, you know, where it plays in the roadmap, because this clearly is part of the roadmap that we've been working with.
So this is what I would describe as a landmark, broad and deep bill that Representative Roy has, as you say, marshaled through the vicissitudes of the legislature. It touches on a lot of things. As I was reading it, I just kept nodding, saying, yep, that's good, that's good, that's good. And the list went on and on. It goes from efforts to make the wind industry better. It goes to efforts to make transit, and particularly focus on electric vehicles, but transit better. It thinks about stuff that we have touched on, Steve, of building the grid. I mean, we've talked many times about how we're going to get power down from Maine or you know, onshore. So there's a ton of really good provisions in the bill that are in service to the roadmap, the 2030 roadmap, where we need to go. And I think that's the way I'd put the question to Representative Roy, is like, what's in the bill? What should people know about it? Why should it be signed? How does it help us get to our 2030 roadmap goals? And congratulations, by the way, for getting it this far. We're all with behind you. So tell me, what is in the bill? What should people know about it?
Well, before I get into that, I need to ask, have you called the governor yet to ask him to sign the bill?
I have. I did the first time around, but while you're talking, I will look up the number and we will list up the governor's number to tell him to call.
Well, I'm going to save you that because I happen to have it right here. Somebody had asked me that very question last night. Uh-huh. And I am going to share that with you. So the office is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And uh-huh. The telephone number is 617-725-4005. Again, 617-725-4005. So
that looks like the title of this podcast.
Perfect. Yes.
That's the name. Yep.
And other than taking notes on that for the listeners, the show notes, as you may have seen for the new ones, you wouldn't have know per se, but the show notes will be chock full of the links to the various pieces that we discussed. So clearly the link to the legislation itself. I believe you shared already the video of your closing remarks advocating for this from the floor. That's a YouTube video. We'll share that. So that you don't have to take notes other than, and we'll give the reminder as well in terms of calling the governor so we can get this moved. And with that, sure. Jeff, you can lead us through it.
So as Ted pointed out, in 2021, I was brand new to this committee. And that was in February of 2021. We had a roadmap bill, which was setting the goal of getting Massachusetts to net zero by 2050. And we set a number of benchmarks every 5 years along that pathway to getting to net zero. And it was putting the goals in place. What this 2022 bill is all about is how do we implement so that we can reach those goals? I took the approach at the beginning of the discussion that in order for us to meet those goals of electrification, we needed to develop a robust source of new clean energy that we could harness, that could feed the needs that we have. And I happened to come into this office at a time when the discussions were really ramping up about offshore wind. We had a new president in the White House who set a goal in his first few months of getting 30 gigawatts of offshore wind in the United States by 2030. The way Massachusetts is situated geographically And with the leasing areas that have already been approved off of the coast of Massachusetts, we are equipped to deliver one third of that national goal. That's 10 gigawatt sites that we can get off of the coast of Massachusetts. So I look at that and I say, this is where we ought to be focusing a lot of our effort. And the bill is carefully calibrated to attract robust clean energy, world-class manufacturing facilities, intensive workforce training initiatives, and the investments that are necessary to prepare our electric distribution system for the energy needs of the future. That, in a nutshell, is what this bill is all about. And during my tenure as the chair of this committee, we became home to the nation's first utility-scale offshore wind farm in November. And I have the shovel right over there in my office to prove it. We broke ground for where the first power line is going to come in from the turbines that are located 14 miles south of Martha's Vineyard. It's at Covell's Beach in Barnstable. And when that project is done and it's connected to New England's power grid in 2023, those turbines will power 400,000 homes. They'll create 3,600 jobs, and they'll save the emissions equivalent of taking 325,000 cars off the road for a year. That's incredible. And that's just phase one of what we have done in terms of expanding offshore wind. In the roadmap bill, we required the administration to get 5,600 megawatts of wind energy. So that's 5.6 gigawatts. It's a little more than half of the one-third goal that I talked about earlier. But we directed the administration to get 5,600 megawatts of offshore wind up and running by 2027. So the first one was Vineyard Wind, which was 800 megawatts. We have, right after Vineyard Wind is done, we have Mayflower Wind coming in to do 1,200 megawatts. And we just had round three of the bidding, which was an additional 1,200 megawatts. So we are at 3,200 megawatts under contract right now. And we're hoping that when the new administration comes in January 2023, we will be seeking another procurement, hopefully for the remaining 2,400 that's been authorized. If they want to do it in packages of 1,200 and 1,200, that's okay too. But I would suggest that probably in the next legislative session, at least I will be pushing for additional procurements to get us up to that 10 gigawatt goal and serve, you know, serve one third of the national goal. And I think we need to go beyond that. So that's a big part of this bill, is developing a robust source of energy. So we focus a lot on offshore wind, but we also know that we have the hydro product project that's coming from Quebec, which now sits in the hands of the Maine Supreme Court. But that, you know, should that pan out, there's a source of clean energy. We've been in discussions with folks. In fact, the Senate president and the state of Maine reached out to me and said, would Massachusetts be interested in procuring onshore wind from northern Maine in Aroostook County? And we authorized the administration to enter into negotiations with other states to procure additional clean power. So, you know, we're looking at those. We have storage pieces in this bill, because in order for this all to work, we've got the wind doesn't blow all the time. The sun doesn't shine all the time. So we need to store this energy for use in those intermittent periods. So we have a lot of effort towards energy storage solutions, be that, you know, battery storage facilities, where, or We even look at the existing hydro storage facilities. I know, Ted, you came out with me to visit ISO. I do plan on getting out to Western Mass to visit one of the big batteries that they have up in the mountain, where they pump water up to a reservoir at the top of the mountain. And when there's a demand for energy, they open the floodgates and that water pours down the mountain and generates power. Those are called the world's largest batteries. Northfield is one. I'm losing the name of the second one, but
Jeff, I just if I could just once, I just wanted to make sure reiterate a point you were making is that the part of the roadmap, part of the strategy is what's called electrification, which is a funny word. You might not recognize what it means, but essentially it means your car is going to be an electric vehicle. Your home is going to be heated by electricity. Everything becomes electric because you don't burn anything anymore. You don't burn any natural gas. The imperative. So if you suddenly think that you're going to have cars and homes being heated, they used to get fossil fuels now coming from electricity, the demand for raw electric power is huge, right? So the prerequisite for the electricity that's going to give you a heat pump and electric vehicle has to be new wind turbines. So that's the connection that people need to get, that the electrification of everything, it's a buzzword, that everything becomes electric instead of any other source, heightens the demand for more and more electricity. And so you wisely focused on the wind turbine and the grid sections of it. And I just, as I grew up in New Bedford, so I'm very proud of the idea that New Bedford's going to have a lot of wind industry with all the associated good. But I mean, I think that's bears reiterating that this is your strategy, is the electrification of everything requires electricity. And so let's make the electricity first.
And let me put that in context for you. And I just pulled out my ISO app, which I have on my phone, and I wanted to see what the fuel mix was for today. Okay. And I'm sure that the listeners of your program know what the ISO app is because you've educated them about that. So it's very hot out there. Very toasty, typical August day, and 72% of the energy that's needed for today is natural gas. So if we're not going to be burning things and we're not going to be using natural gas, then we need to come up with something that's going to replace 72% of our energy needs. And that was really a lot of the discussion we were having as a committee. And how do we do that? And I was convinced the only way to do that is to focus on developing robust sources of energy. So a lot of attention was paid to that issue. And, you know, I just look at this app and 72% natural gas, 19% nuclear, 7% renewables, 2% hydro. You know, that's
a typical
summer scenario. You know, when we were getting the cold snaps in the winter, oil was in the mix, you know, and natural gas was high. So that really does tell a huge picture and why we focus so much on developing a source of energy.
Legislature says you will procure X amount of wind energy, some number of gigawatts, right? Who gets told to do what? Does the DOER solicits bids?
Yes, they'll do an RFP process where they will say, this is what we're looking for. And in fact, if you look at the bill that we passed, we adjusted some of the things that we want them to look for. We wanted more economic development. We want diversity, equity, inclusion. We want environmental protections and fisheries mitigation. So we spelled that all out to the administration. It is the Department of Energy Resources, DOER. They will develop the RFP, and then they'll send it out to the world and attract bids. One of the curious things is we have not received many bids. And one of the complaints we heard is that Massachusetts has a price cap that is not enticing to companies to come in. And the price cap was put in place in 2016 when we were initially getting involved in the offshore wind space. And, you know, there were concerns that offshore wind was going to come in the 15 to 25 cent range. It was going to be really pricey and nobody would buy it. So we put a price cap in place to make sure that we didn't have these outrageous prices. Well, lo and behold, wind energy comes in at 6.5 cents and 5.8 cents. So, you know, we realized, hey, we really can relax on the price cap. The governor wanted to relax the price cap. The House wanted to relax the price cap, and the Senate was not really on board. They did eventually come around when we did the amendments last week. But what we're trying to do is to get more players into this area, more companies to bid. There are four major companies.
Jeff, when you say bid, I just want to, again, to be clear, what we're talking about is like big firms, a contractor will come in and say, I have enough financial power to build a wind farm off Massachusetts. And if you pay me X cents per kilowatt hour, I will go ahead and build that. Right. So you're looking exactly for corporate players to make a bid and attracting those. Oh, we have Mayflower Wind, right? Which is based.
Well, we have Vineyard Wind.
Vineyard Wind. Right. Right.
We have Mayflower Wind. And the two players that have not made a bid in Massachusetts are Ørsted, which has its company headquarters in Massachusetts, but they didn't bid into this market. And Equinor has not bid into this market. So by removing the price cap, we're enticing them to bid into this market. But we're also saying, bring some jobs to Massachusetts, bring some manufacturing facilities to Massachusetts, bring some economic opportunity to Massachusetts. We have been saying that message for over a year. And I will say that the last bid that came in, I think these companies were hearing us loud and clear, because the last bid that came in included a manufacturing facility at Brayton Point in Somerset. Now, I'm not sure if you are familiar or your listeners are familiar, but let me tell you, Brayton Point was the home to the last coal-fired plant in Massachusetts. It went up in smoke in about 5 years ago. They had an implosion of the towers down in Brayton Point, and people were watching it on TV or mm-hmm. out in boats. It was mm-hmm. a huge symbolic move to get Massachusetts out of coal. However, it left 42 barren acres in Brayton Point in Somerset. And having this manufacturing facility come in and set up a shop on that 42 acres, they are going, it's an Italian manufacturer called Prysmian. They are going to manufacture all of the cables that are going to bring the power from the turbines to the land. And conceivably, they will be manufacturing the cables for the entire East Coast. Company is expected to deliver 200 to 300 jobs at that particular location. And it's such a poetic change of use for that land. And the people of Somerset are embracing it. And I think breathing a deep sigh of relief that the transformation that happened in their backyard.
Hey, Jeff, you're completely right. I think you just said poetic, which is, I have driven across the Braga Bridge many times and seen that power plant. I was attending protests against the power plant before it shut down. And the people in the town were legitimately afraid of the loss of the tax base, the jobs, but the transformations come about. So now I think it's fair to say the town is much more supportive and enthusiastic because there's this clean facility there. And it's a wonderful example of what can be done, right? Where we're headed if we're smart, right?
It's absolutely.
I think to reinforce that point, I think one of the key pieces as I've been reading and following along, clearly to go from, as you referenced the data, the 72%, 70 plus percent of natural gas getting to another piece. That's a shift. That's a transition. It's not going to happen overnight, but it needs to start. And by making the moves as I understand, you've been dealing with the legislation, and then hopefully the governor will sign and thereby embody in the process. That's creating the infrastructure truly that will either hopefully build and thereby increase the jobs, will provide the greenness that we need from an electoral perspective. And then there's going to be domino effects all the way along, because as that electricity starts coming, then we'll have to be preparing both in the homes and in the buildings to shift as well from the oil burners, the gas burners, to the heat pumps. And there's another source of, you know, labor resources that are either going to have to be put together and or trained, retrained from, say, the fuel guy now delivering a heat pump, right? There's a lot of opportunity there. And I think that's really what one of the key aspects of the legislation, as I understand it, certainly the roadmap and meeting that, all of those things need to be in there as well.
Yeah. And so let me give you a little highlight of how we do this. Okay. I talked to you about removing the price cap. We also set up an offshore wind industry investment program and a trust fund that we're going to put money in to offer incentives to companies to promote manufacture, fabrication, and assembly of domestic supply chain components in the offshore wind industry. We're going to advocate and advance clean energy research and technology and innovation. We're, you know, looking for ways to make this wind power more efficient, and ways to, you know, maybe the shape of the blades, the material that the blades are made of. We have some of the best research institutions in the world right here in Massachusetts. So we're going to capitalize on that. And we're also going to use some of that money to prepare individuals for offshore wind careers. So we're going to do workforce training. One component of this bill will offer incentives to high schools to offer industry recognized credentialing in the offshore wind industry to get kids excited about this new industry right now. We're going to offer $35 million in annual tax incentives to, you know, invite people to create jobs and spend capital investments here. So the one of the ways to get a tax incentive is if you have a commitment to create at least 50 net new permanent full-time employees within the state, you're eligible for a tax credit. And if you spend at least $35 million in capital investments for an offshore wind facility and employ at least 200 new full-time employees, you'll be eligible for a tax credit. And we have a clawback. So if you don't deliver what you said you're going to deliver, we're taking it back. I outlined some of the changes in the offshore wind procurement process in terms of what preferences we want the administration to give and what we require the bids to look like, and removing the price cap. That's part of it. We have a commercial fisheries commission that's established in this. It's going to work with the fishermen in down in New Bedford, all the way up to Gloucester, and you know, make sure that they're going to be able to stay in business.
Jeff, since you mentioned, I just had this image. You're talking about workforce training, offshore wind workforce training, right? And so this thing flashed in my head of modern day analog of the fishermen of Gloucester, you know, that statue in Gloucester where the guy is sailing, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be an offshore wind turbine worker, right? There's a whole culture because you have to go out and there's hundreds of these wind turbines eventually. You need to service them. It's an adventurous life. And I don't know, maybe there'll be a statue there someday. Maybe you'll be the model, Jeff. You can be the model for the.
I have done some of the training, believe it or not. There's a company here in Massachusetts that's created a virtual reality module for repairing a nacelle. The nacelle is the unit that's at the top of the turbine. So I actually participated in this training program by hopping onto a boat, driving out to the turbine, climbing up onto the turbine, climbing the ladder up to the top of the turbine, entering the nacelle, taking my tools, and moving around in the nacelle to make adjustments to the equipment. all done in virtual reality, a much safer way to train an employee how to work this. Mass Maritime Academy has a whole program down there already training future employees in this industry. And we're also building, as part of Bristol Community College, a wind center down in New Bedford. And, you know, you want some more poetry? Well, you know, 100 years ago, New Bedford lit the world with whale oil. And today they're going to light and power the world with offshore wind. So more poetry there. And I'll even take you further up north, up to Salem. Salem, the port in Salem, offers an incredible opportunity for delivery of these Jones Act vessels. None of the other ports in Massachusetts can host a Jones Act vessel.
What's
because, for example, these huge monster ships, they can't get under the bridges to Brayton Point. And in New Bedford, there's a hurricane wall that has a passage area that's too small for one of these vessels. So Salem offers a deep water port, and with some investments there, we can turn that into the hub for offshore wind delivery systems. Maine is looking at offshore wind, and they'll take deliveries through Salem. And here's the beauty of Salem. Salem was also the home for a coal-fired plant. They removed that coal-fired plant, and they replaced it with a highly efficient natural gas power plant. But that natural gas power plant has a 50-year license. In 2050, that facility closes. And I believe if we get Salem up and running, that will be another transfer of offshore energy replacing a retiring natural gas facility. So lots of amazing things happening in Massachusetts, and this legislation can really push us forward. And I joke with some of the young people in the State House when we talk about it. I said, I'm going to be 89 years old in 2050. So probably not going to benefit tremendously, other than I'll be living in a beautifully air-conditioned old age home. But for you folks, this is your future, and we're watching what's happening in the world with droughts and fires and floods and warming oceans. We're doing something today to protect this planet for you and your future, and we owe it to you. And we're going to deliver. And I'm going to remind folks that we can't do that without the governor's signature on this bill. So if you didn't hear me earlier in the program, you need to call the governor and urge him to put his signature on this bill.
617-725-4005.
Perfect.
Write that on the back of your hand. Get a pen right now. Write it on the back of your hand and call the governor.
You know, some other features of this bill that I didn't touch upon. So that's the robust energy. But we also have to make the grid ready for the delivery of all of this energy. So in this bill, we call for some independent transmission planning, asking the administration to look at whether they can solicit proposals in conjunction and coordination with other states for independent transmission to deliver offshore wind to the existing grid. We also create a clean energy transmission working group that's going to analyze the costs, the cost allocation measures, and regional coordination opportunities for taking care of transmission of this energy. Then
but transmission, Jeff, forgive me for interrupting. Again, we're talking about power lines capable of carrying all this great electricity that we've generated. That needs to be integrated into existing power lines and new ones. And I congratulate you and the legislature, because it's increasingly clear that there is a regional thing here that extends beyond Massachusetts. So coordinating with other states is critically important, I think, too.
We're encouraging and giving the administration authorization to do it on a regional basis. Then you look at our grid. We establish a grid modernization planning council that has to see, so transmission is getting the power from the huge power lines and from the turbines into the land. Once it gets in the land, then it goes into our grid. And how do we move this power along from that transmission line to the plugs in your home? And the grid was designed for a system where power moved in one direction. And with people putting solar panels on their homes and, you know, I've seen windmills on property, we need to develop a grid that moves in multiple ways so that we can take advantage of all that solar energy that you have on your house and put it back into the grid. We can set up the battery storage facilities that we need and move this power cleanly and efficiently through the system. So that's typically something that's done by the Department of Public Utilities. But I will say in all candor, we have not been impressed with the level of speed that they have been pursuing this particular issue. So this Grid Modernization Planning Council will light a fire on those efforts to modernize our grid. And then, you know, then we move into the green transportation sectors, the electric vehicles that we talked about earlier, the electric buses that we want to get to, the electric trains that we want to get to. And I'll share with you, we did receive some criticism that that we are banning gas-powered vehicles in 2035. And I say, I'd love to take credit for that, but that's not something that's in this bill. In fact, that's something we did back in 1991 when we tied our emission standards to those in California. And we embraced California's emission standards, and they're going to ban gas-powered vehicles by 2035. So that comes down to Massachusetts. And in fact, when the governor issued his plan in December of 2021, he banned gas-powered vehicles after 2035. What we did in this bill to further that effort was said that any dealer that sells a gas-powered vehicle after 2035 would be violating the Consumer Protection Act. So, yeah, we did something on the gas-powered vehicles, but I'm not patting myself on the back for getting the ban underway, because that was done long before we got here. And the other piece is building decarbonization. We know that buildings are responsible for so much of our emissions. So we do some promotion of geothermal technology. We do some further incentives for buildings to convert. We require the larger buildings to issue reports on the emissions that are coming from their buildings. We incorporated some changes to Mass Save, which is the consumer program that most people who have an audit of their home, that's done under Mass Save. And then that provides you with some incentives to put the heat pumps or highly efficient devices in your home.
And Jeff, that's an important sort of new thing, is that Mass Save is basically help you decarbonize by working with on the heat pump stuff, right? And that's new, right, in this bill, which is a great thing, right?
Right, and we're telling them in their next plan. So right now, you still can get incentives for, fossil fuel equipment, highly efficient boiler is covered under MassSafe currently, but in the next plan that they issue, which will be in about 3 years. We've told them no more incentives for fossil fuel equipment in the next thing. And an interesting piece that is part of the bill is trying a pilot program allowing 10 communities to ban fossil fuel in any new construction or major renovation. I will say, and I'll admit clear cut, that I wasn't a fan of this proposal because I thought it was giving rich communities a way to push fossil fuels out of their communities, and it was going to have an impact on poorer or environmental justice communities. And I said, you know, we should all be in this together. In the roadmap bill, we asked the administration to develop a new specialized stretch energy code that would deal with these issues. Let's let that take place. But, you know, at the end of the day, you have to compromise. And I did compromise on this particular component, but insisted that before a community could participate, they had to be compliant with 40B in that they had 10% affordable housing in their community before they could apply. And we also exempted life sciences labs, hospitals, and other healthcare facilities from that requirement because they need power, and electrification is not at the stage that could run a lab or a medical facility. And finally, we have robust reporting requirements for that pilot in that we want to see some data, and we want to see if that pilot program has been effective in reducing emissions and helping us achieve our goals. I mean, those are, you know, that's what this is all about.
Those are great. I mean, I appreciate your sort of sensitivity to the fact that the way the gas system disappears is going to may perhaps unduly burden people who are in disadvantaged communities. That's an important thing. And so I think that's a great, for my money, that's a great addition. And I think that the lessons learned aspect of keeping track of what the consequences of these 10 towns, because what you want you do, in my mind, the justification for the 10 towns is to learn how it all goes, right? So the tracking after the fact is, again, a value add that I think is really a good piece. So.
Yeah. And it's, you know, look, at we're all in this together, and we don't want to unfairly burden those communities who have not up to now really had the benefit of real clean, renewable energy. We want to make sure that they have a seat at the table and that they're not getting the burden of dirty fuel while certain communities are 100% clean. So we've seen a track record in the past that, you know, you look at the biomass plant that they were trying to build in Springfield, which has some of the highest rates of asthma anywhere. And, you know, we closed the door on that. You know, you can't continue to put these dirty plants and make people sick. You know, we have a responsibility, we have an obligation, and I think we met those duties and obligations in so many ways with this bill. And you know, it's the result of compromise that was, you know, hard fought throughout this process, and there was a lot of give and take by everyone to get us to this stage. And when I was making my remarks, because, you know, I've heard the governor is not terribly thrilled with everything that's in the bill, and he wanted some further changes. We made some of those changes. We didn't make others. And I said the art of compromise got us to where we are today with this bill. And I shared with my colleagues, when I was doing my remarks, I said, I read a good description of compromise recently from a book, and I want to share that with you. And I'm going to share that with your listeners right now, because this is what it says in that book. It says, compromise comes from an understanding that we all have different life experiences, perspectives, and interests. It acknowledges that there are multiple ways to achieve the same end and multiple steps along the way. Compromise recognizes not only specific interests, but also the interests of the whole community. It can be the forerunner of progress in breaking the rigidity of all or nothing and the gridlock that may ensue. Now, here's the interesting piece. That excerpt is from the book Results, Getting Beyond Politics to Get Important Work Done. And the author of that book is none other than our governor, from the book that he published just a few weeks ago. And I think that line speaks to who he is as a person and what this moment is all about. And we're calling on him to compromise. He didn't get everything that he wanted in the bill. I didn't get everything that I wanted in the bill. The Senate didn't get everything they wanted in the bill. The Senate president didn't get what she wanted. The speaker didn't get what he wanted. The minority leaders in both chambers didn't get what they wanted. But we came together, and many of us have different thoughts about what should be there. We all walk away a little unhappy, and that tells me that we created a good bill, because we all recognize there's no single correct way to get things done. And sometimes we have to compromise for the greater good. And I'm calling on the governor to compromise for the greater good, because as we outlined here today, there are some great things in this bill that will make meaningful steps towards curbing further global warming and climate change damage for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And the time is now. This is the president came to Massachusetts 2 weeks ago and said climate change is a clear and present danger. We can't wait. It's urgent. We need to act now. And he needs to sign that bill. Did I mention that earlier?
I think you did.
Thank you.
We'll say it again.
We'll make sure people listen. Now, I think this has been insightful, enlightening. The art of compromise, certainly for us in particular in the Commonwealth of Mass. That's kind of been one of the themes where, as Ted and I and others have been talking through the roadmap, it seems like different aspects have had disconnects along the way. And I appreciate the efforts of the art of compromise coming together so to rectify so that we can go forward with less of those disconnects. It's not a perfect world. Things will still happen, but you've also built into it the lessons learned aspect. So, okay, let's let the 10 communities go off and do the pilot before we have the other 340 try to go down the road and we find out it's the wrong way to go. Let's build that in so we can do the right thing and get to the better place, which we're all getting older and the young certainly going to benefit more from it as we go forward. So thank you for your efforts to that extent. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, I am, and I said it to the speaker when the session ended Monday morning. I walked up to him on the rostrum and I just said, thank you for the opportunity that you gave me to do this work. It's been so meaningful. It was a challenge. I'm exhausted at the end of this session and but it's some real important work, and I'm grateful that he had the confidence in me to do it. And I think it helps that I have a community in Franklin and Medway who gave me this opportunity 10 years ago and had the confidence in me. And I hope that they see that this is delivering on the promises that I made 10 years ago and every 2 years thereafter.
Put in the additional plug, the call the governor, email the governor, contact him, use whatever channels you can. Because as Jeff has mentioned before at the beginning, he has three actions due by the 11th. He can sign it. He can do nothing and let it go. Both of those would really be good. At least we get where we need to be immediately. And there's still a whole lot of work to do. And then, unfortunately, if he does veto it, that work just gets a little bit harder in terms of time sensitivity. It doesn't go away. Stay tuned. We'll probably be back for another session, clearly after August 11th, and we'll give you some chance to figure out, what just happened? How do we do this? What do we do from here? Yep. So that the listeners will be able to come along the road as we get towards a better set of climate in the Commonwealth and as well beyond that, because clearly it's not just us. There's a whole lot of folks with us.
Great. Well, I thank you guys for doing this series. It's been incredible. And, I always tell people, I say, I have a gem in my community in Ted McIntyre, who's been teaching me about climate issues for years. And I'm just glad that I got put in a position where I could actually do something about it. And Steve, you've been educating this community for 20 years, and putting together this whole program on the climate issues has been great. I've enjoyed it, and I'm glad that you did it. And I'm glad that I got a chance to weigh in and share with what I've been doing. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm not quite at 20 years yet, but it certainly feels like 20.
Well, you were there when I started on the school committee. So I'm just trying to do the math.
Yeah. Yeah. The time just flies because we're having some fun. So, you know, well, thank you both for participating today. For the listeners, thank you for listening to this.
In collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin
Public Radio. And we do this all because
this podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.
So there you go. That's the situation. Call the governor. 617-725-4005. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.